Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal. This is our 114th podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for subscribing to the Fretboard Journal magazine. Our new issue, issue 36, is out now. Derek Trucks is on the cover. Lots of other great features. If you're into the world of luthery, we've got a great piece on Irvin Samadji and his apprenticeship program that's been going on for many years, and a lot more. So get that issue. You can go to fretboardjournal.com to do it. Today we are talking to Otto D'Ambrosio. Otto is a tremendous luthier, known mainly probably for his jazz and art shop style guitars, but he's been building all sorts of guitars. And as he tells us in this conversation, he's had a pretty interesting life. You know, he grew up in Staten Island, went to Mandolin Brothers, became enamored with that little universe, went under Stan Jay's wing for a little bit, trained with Flip Scipio, apprenticed with John Monteleone. He's kind of worked with some heavyweights, and he's since setting out on his own, been doing some absolutely beautiful guitars, and he has also been working with Eastman to make them slightly more affordable. So we get to hear all about what he's doing for Eastman guitars in California. He's relocated even his shop and everything. It's very cool. So just want to do one quick announcement. I know I keep talking about it. The Fretboard Summit is happening October 14th through 16th in San Diego, California. I hope to see some of the Fretboard Journal podcast listeners there. It is going to be a wild, crazy, amazing weekend. This is a pretty immersive, cool 3-day getaway where you can meet many of your guitar making and guitar playing heroes. Sean Watkins of Nickel Creek is going to be there, Matt Munisteri, Courtney Hartman, Eric Skye. So many great players are going to be there playing, and a couple of surprise guests that we will not announce just yet. And then pretty much so many of the subjects of the Fretboard Journal magazine are going to be there. It's going to be kind of crazy. TJ Thompson is going to be there, Bill Collings, Richard Hoover of Santa Cruz Guitars, Dana Bourgeois. On and on, on and on. I know Joe Glazer's coming in from Nashville, Roger Sadowski from New York, just a ton of great people. Michael Gurian, who I just had dinner with. So if you are at all interested in the world of guitars and want to just learn and meet as many of these guys as humanly possible in the span of 2.5 days, fretboardsummit.com, sign yourself up, invite your friends. All right, without further ado, here is our conversation with Otto D'Ambrosio. Thank you so much for tuning in, everybody. Well, Otto, thank you so much for taking this call with us. I've been following your career for a long while, and I have always thought of you as an East Coast guy, but you are a West Coast guy now, and I want to get to that, but before we chat about what you're up to these days, can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into the guitar?
How I got into the guitar business. I guess it kind of all started working at Mandolin Brothers 25 plus years ago.
Yep.
I walked into that shop at the age of 13 years old and asked Stan Jay for a job.
What did he give you?
He humbled me by asking me to take out the trash and dust guitars. But these guitars became, you know, more than just guitars for me. So I got to see, you know, some of the most prized pieces in the 90s and later 90s and 2000s. So just some unbelievable Martins and D'Angelicos and D'Acquistos and Monteleones and all that stuff. That was how I got into it. And from there, just kind of got down to the repair shop and worked with all the guys in the basement there restoring these instruments. And then had a couple internships with some of the builders that went through that place.
And you were a Staten Island kid, and that's what was the draw? Or you just wanted to be around Mandolin Brothers?
I'm sorry?
Did you grow up in Staten Island?
I did grow up in Staten Island, yeah.
Okay, so Mandolin Brothers was an institution that you could see out your car window once in a while.
Yeah, we drove up and down Forest Avenue, you know, frequently. And, you know, I think my father you know, at one point said, hey, you're into music, you know, and of course I was in some punk thrash band or something, and he's like, yeah, I'm into music, sure. I said, yeah, you should check this place out. It's pretty unbelievable.
And did the love was, you know, did the love for Arch Chops happen at Mandolin Brothers, or at that point were you still kind of loving everything?
You know, I mean, certainly loving the more wild stuff at that point, but it really became clear, you know, at that time with what Jimmy was doing and what John was doing, that Arch Tops were, you know, they are the high art of Luthery. Yeah. And, you know, I figured, you know, in all my teenage wisdom, hey, if I can make one of those, like, you know, I could do anything, man. I could do anything I want. So I guess that's where I ended up trying to start, was with the Arch Top. But, you know, it was another 10 years after that before I even got there.
And who was your first apprenticeship with?
First one, I went to work with Flip Scipio. And Flip kind of solidified the real passion and romance of the guitar for me. We discovered a lot of awesome stuff together with guitars and just shops in general, I guess, and players. You know, that's when the first, you know, really got to see some unbelievable talented musicians.
Yeah, a lot of talented guys use Flip. Was your role there mainly kind of in the restoration and kind of repair aspect of things?
Yeah, I mean, he obviously did the bigger jobs.
Yeah.
The restorations, and so I was there mainly to, you know, understand setups and playability and fretwork and neck sets and all of the, you know, the real nuts and bolts of putting instruments together.
Yeah, and then where'd you go after that?
I had a brief spat with John Monteleone.
Okay.
So I would commute from Staten Island to Islip, you know, on and off for a couple of years. That was a pretty intimidating part of my career, I think. You know, I remember just wrestling with the idea of you know, Mandolin Brothers and Flip Shop. It was really nice and fun, where John was really about, you know, about working and working hard, you know.
Yeah.
I was still kind of naive then, so I took in as much as I possibly could with him, and that was the beginning of real woodworking too, I guess. So that was cutting, you know, large pieces of wood and milling and planing and pantograph routing and carving, and which was all new to me at that time.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think of John as having too many apprentices. Was that a pretty rare thing for you to be there?
It was actually. I don't think I was there as an apprentice in the beginning. It started off with, I think Larry Wexer mentioned that John was looking for someone to help him restore and maintain his instruments for his customers.
Okay.
So I think he was, I think I remember clearly, he did pay me for work.
Nice.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. I remember that was, but I mean, it wasn't that much. It was, you know, a few mandolins here or there. And it was just the repair work. And then it became a point where he said, you know what? I don't want to pay you anymore. Can you just be my intern?
Kind of a reverse of normal, yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, well, man, I you know, I'm living by myself. I need to pay the bills. And it's, you know, gas is crazy. At that time, I think it was like, you know, 99 cents a gallon or something.
And that was a commute, right?
And that was a commute, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a grind, you know, going over Bell Parkway and all the way out to, out there, I mean, but it was an unbelievable experience for the time we had together.
And at this point, had the seeds been planted that you were going to become a solo luthier and kind of do your own thing, or are you still kind of figuring out your place in this industry?
You know, I mean, that was pretty much it. I just needed to figure out, my road to do it. You know, in New York City at that time, there was, some of the greatest builders and certainly the most famous builders, I guess, at that time. And one shop was there. 48th Street was there.
Yeah.
So, and everybody had their own thing. So I just had to figure out how I was going to, get there to be a builder. But yeah, it was, from then I figured that the best step would be to get some real production experience.
Okay.
And that was, figured out that since Flip and some mutual friends had, positions a while back at Guild Guitars and they were in New England, that I figured I would get a job at Guild and figure out my ropes there.
And how was that?
A whole new world.
Guild at this point was where? Remind me.
They were in Westerly.
In Westerly still, okay.
Yeah, so I had moved from Staten Island to Westerly, Rhode Island. And, it was a factory of about 100 employees. And, I was lucky enough to have a position in the customer repair department. So there's only five of us there, but it wasn't, anything but repair. It was, totally removing tops and backs off guitars, rebuilding them, rebracing, carving, gluing, neck setting, finishing, because it was kind of like its own shop within itself.
Okay.
So we were kind of left alone as long as the repair. The repairs got out, and the workload was just unbelievable. I mean, there was just rows and rows of instruments that, the shop manager would just say, take five and start on them this week, So you'd be like rotating a dozen or 15 instruments at a time that all needed extensive work.
Wow.
But that's really where it became important for me to learn all of the machinery and tools and millwork, which started a new passion at that point, because the woodworking in guitar making sometimes gets lost today, I think.
Sure.
Where if you can start with raw materials, you can really find these perfect pieces for wood and it really makes instruments become really special.
Yeah. And did you end the Guild job, or did the Guild job end?
The writing was on the wall at that time.
Okay.
Fender had already purchased them, and everybody seemed to know that the days were numbered. So I think I got up to the last year, and then finally just said, all right, I'm going to try this for myself. And at that point, got my own shop and continued to repair instruments, out of the shop. And then finally get up to building, which was about 2000, I guess, or 2001, I think.
And how, I guess this is the million-dollar question, but how does, in a world of, arch-top jazz guitars, how do you, in 2000, kind of set yourself apart from all the established players, the Mono Leones, the guys who are already been doing this for years? What was your strategy there?
At that point, I was, really just trying to figure out how to build a perfect instrument. And I guess I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
It was at a point where I understood, how to make them play as well as I could. So now it was just kind of putting all the pieces together. So, certainly having the history of repairing and figuring out what went wrong, I mean, that helped out a lot to make a better instrument. But creatively. I mean, that's where you can take some liberties to set yourself apart. So, you know, whether it be design or just the function of an instrument, how it's played, you know, you can really kind of set yourself apart from another maker or another builder.
Sure. Building your shop, I mean, you'd already been exposed to the back room at Mandolin Brothers, Flip Shop, John's Shop, yeah. and then Guild. What was your strategy just kind of putting the tooling together? Were you trying to have a little automation, or were you trying to be really, you know, hands-on with everything? What was your kind of philosophy there?
Yeah, Rhode Island was a special place because it had such a an industry, you know, blue-collar mentality there. I mean, this place was set up as a jewelry manufacturing in the 40s. It was one of the biggest in the world. So machinery and tools, and especially woodworking equipment, seemed like it was everywhere. I mean, there was shops and friends, mutual friends that had shops. And so, you know, setting up a shop came fairly easy and for, you know, minimal cost.
Sure.
Workspace was, you know, relatively cheap. So to walk into a mill, you know, you can get 1,000 square feet for under $300 a month.
Crazy.
So, I mean, and it didn't take much to, you know, do a couple repairs in a fret job, and it's paid for. So, setting up the shop came pretty easy. As far as, you know, whether it was hands-on, I mean, it's still all hands-on. You know, automation is great, but I kind of still prefer regular templates. And, you know, maybe a pin router here or there, but standard routers are always kind of the easiest to set up and tool and break down. I don't have a million of the same routers to do different jobs. It's one, I enjoy the, you know, changing bits and sharpening a bit here or there, and, you know, sharpening a chisel and you know, my planes. You got to have a sharp plane.
Yeah.
Automation, I love the idea of it. And certainly as time goes on and my wrists hurt more, it'll become more important, you know. It's still... A lot of it is still really hands-on.
Yeah. And what was the first kind of guitar model that you locked into back there?
You know, I guess the 01 was the first one that that I had. So it was just a big 17-inch oval hole. You know, very simple, classic styling, you know, very slope-shouldered, very low arch. You know, but just premier woods and, you know, lighter finishes, of course. So that was the first one that just, you know, sounds really tons of depth.
Yeah.
To the voice.
And was that inspired by an instrument you saw of Jimmy's or John's at one point, or that you wanted to kind of evolve from, or you just kind of latched onto that style?
Well, I mean, I always thought that was a jazz archtop guitar. There was a purpose for that guitar outside of mainstream jazz.
Sure.
You know, and I always imagined a crossover, you know, player out there, that someone that might want to do finger style on a lighter built, you know, oval hole. So it was always, you know, the idea was to make it lighter and airier, you know, not as compressed and projection. I guess I kind of lost a little projection with those guitars. Whereas, you know, the older jazz guitars are kind of more heavily built, but they mm-hmm. chunk, you know, they have the sound that just kind of goes through anything. Where these were a little more delicate, a little more, you know, for someone sitting in a living room and just kind of, you know, that wants to get a little more delicate with the sound.
Got it. And how many of those did you build?
Probably about half a dozen.
Okay.
Of those, of that model. Whereas then things started to progress into a smaller-bodied, sleek 16-inch model called the Allegro, which I had a lot of fun with manipulating pick guards and integrating pickups into these pick guards, and everything floated off the neck. And it was a real pain in the butt to make them, but in the end, it was just this seamless kind of flowing, you know, piece of ebony, you know, that just that looked great off the top of the guitar.
Yeah, yeah. And are you experimenting with tone woods at this point, or are you kind of latched on to what these models need?
Yeah, the oval holes, I certainly experimented with redwood. I think there's a cedar out there, but the spruces really, I mean, they were always kind of the more, you know, common top that I use. So usually Sitka. I like Sitka a lot. I did have some really nice pieces of old Adirondack that I used, but they were extremely bright, you know, just really, really bright and crystally sounding.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Usually I talk to flat top builders and they always lean towards Adirondack or red, but I guess for your purposes, the Sitka actually works better?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly like it. It kind of rounds off the edges for an arch top.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I've done a few with Engelmann as well, which really rounds off the edges a lot, and it just kind of sounds a little flat, which can, you know, sound great for an arch top if you kind of want a muted acoustic.
Yeah. And what do you think that the is the arch top or the oval hole versus F hole, like, is one easier, harder to pull off on your end? At this point, you've done hundreds of both, but I'm just kind of curious, does one style pose more challenges than the other?
You know, the F hole, you have a visual reference on how thin you're going on your recurve, which is great, you know. But in the oval hole, you kind of don't. And it really sounds like a different instrument, so you're voicing it totally differently than the F-hold models. But yeah, I always found the overhaul to be a little trickier than the F or the S.
And you know, what was the reaction you were getting from players? I'm just curious.
I mean, they always love them.
Yeah.
It's great. I mean, that's why shows, I always love doing shows because you can, you know, visually, you know, there's a lot of players that just like a very classic styled, you know, jazz guitar. But on the other hand, there's certainly more modern guys that want to have something that's from the future, which I always love to do, but, you know, always have a hard time selling.
Yeah, sure. One-offs.
Yeah.
How did the Allegro and the O1 kind of evolved over the years? What changes did you see in those?
Yeah, mostly just with woods. It's just trying to figure out what the best wood was for those models.
Yeah.
You know, the Allegros, it turned immediately into German materials. So, you know, wood from the Alps. So figured maple from Switzerland or Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas the ovals are all domestic, so, you know, big leaf maple or something with real wide grain that's a little softer, because that kind of brings out the warmth and depth of a oval hole larger guitar.
Now, American woods for the oval hole, European woods for the F-holes. Was that kind of an intentional thing, or after a lot of experimentation, it just kind of panned out that way?
It really just kind of happened that way.
Interesting.
You know, yeah, I just found, you know, the oval holes were drawn to, you know, being, they were a faster build. They tended to only be non-cutaways, and to really get the resonance and kind of like, you know, jaw-dropping boom that I wanted, it turned into softer woods, whereas which are grown faster domestically, and the smaller body guitars seem to respond and resonate better with something a little stiffer, a little closer grained, which at that point you can carve way lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And the 16s really started to change when, you know, I was reducing the bridge height, you know, to, you know, just over 3/4. Actually, lower than that for some of them. So just almost no down pressure on the top of them.
But, interesting.
You know, they were carved to a point where, you know, you didn't even have to, you know, hit the string and it would start to vibrate. But yeah, so those were the two material differences for the guitars.
Yeah. How many guitars did you build out of your East Coast workshop?
I mean, half of the business was always restoring.
Sure.
So, you know, one or two, you know, very extensive restorations, you know, which was usually on the DA or Jimmy's guitar.
Sure.
And then it was, you know, a handful of repairs over the year.
Sure.
So it was really about 50-50.
Okay.
As far as workload went. So I think, you know, about maybe total East Coast hand-built guitars is somewhere like 35, I think, at this mm-hmm. point.
And then what brought you to California? Let's talk about this.
Yeah. the big question. You know, it was just a question. It was hey, you know, I've been working with Eastman for, you know, 10 years at that point.
Yeah.
And the president of the company asked me to do a small job, which was for a celebrity.
Okay.
And it seemed to go so well at that point that, you know, he said, hey, I have this idea. We're bringing all of, you know, our sales guys in-house, and how about if you be our design element for Eastman guitars in-house? You know, and I had to think about that for a while. You know, that was a 6 month kind of thought process, but yeah, ultimately I said sure. You know, with the vision of starting a custom shop for Eastman guitars.
Mm-hmm. And let's go back just a minute, because what was your first working relationship with Eastman? I know you designed a couple of instruments for them, or maybe more, but when did that first start, and did they approach you? Did you approach them? How did that all work out?
Yeah, it was very early on. So I think of 2002, we had done a show together, and by chance it was the Classic American Guitar Show, which course doesn't happen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the premier art shop show in Long Island. So I was showing some art shops there, and I think they had approached me at that point, and they were showing as well, and they needed a lot of help at that time. So they had asked for just, you know, help with the details, help with, you know everything, really. So there was the beginning of working with Eastman was just, you know, hey, the bridge goes here. Hey, you can't play this guitar, man. The frets are all over the place. Let's do a fret job, which was once again it just backed up, you know, all this the repair experience, which you have to know.
Sure. So it wasn't as much at first, give us some new designs. It was more like, we've got these guitars coming in from China. Can we make them playable?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then after that point, it became, all right, if we're going to really have a go at this, we need to have some identifiable Eastman designs. We need to design a rosette. We need to do this. We need to, you know, and that it kind of just went off from there to designing a signature model for them, which was the El Rey,
mm-hmm.
which was in 2005. So yeah, it was always a working relationship with them.
Yeah. And then tell me about this move and tell me about this sort of custom shop idea and just, you know, what the Eastman California workshop looks like.
Well, it's getting there, I'll tell you.
Sure.
We started an expansion build out probably in February of this year.
Okay.
And I think it's about 12,000 square feet, but that houses, so upstairs we have a photography studio, a recording studio, a little ISO booth, you know, a bunch of nice cubicles and space and green room. But that space was not used for since they own the building, so 5 years now. It was never kind of used for anything other than some photography. So they kind of repurposed it all. And in that, they said, hey, do you want to shop in there?
Mm-hmm.
So we finally discussed, you know, the idea of putting a shop in, and they put it on the ground floor, which I'm very happy for. So yeah, there's about 1,400 square feet.
Okay.
That has some, you know, some very similar tools to the Rhode Island shop. You know, have a nice workbench that overlooks the San Bernardinos when you can see them.
Yeah.
it is a warehouse primarily for, you know, all of the importing and exporting.
Sure.
We do out of here. But there's two buildings. One side is more strings, so all of the violins come through one side and all the guitars come through the other.
Got it.
They have a small workshop for the string side. So we're just kind of starting the guitar side repair.
Nice.
Guitar. Yep.
And did you move your personal workshop to California too, or are you just kind of all Eastman all the time right now?
No, I my personal workshop was moved into the Eastman headquarters.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, brings up a lot of questions, but it's going to be fine, though. So I have my bench here and, you know, all my tools and table saws and presses and buffing wheels and saws and all those great things.
Yeah. And let's,
yeah, it's in Eastman now, yeah.
Yeah. Talk to me about what's going on at Eastman and what you're working on. Obviously, the guitars, I've seen them. You don't have to worry about playability anymore. You figured that out.
Yeah.
They sound and play great. But, you know, what's your kind of vision for how this evolves?
We're thinking of a five-year plan. That's another reason why Eastman is so great. They've really worked on, they will work on things, and it doesn't have to be done right now.
Yeah.
It would be great if it did, but I know it won't be. So stage one is going to be white wood builds. So a guitar will come in two pieces and unfinished. And we will do a neck set. So once again, all goes back to repair work.
yeah, you just can't escape it. I mean, it's
your yeah, fate. No, I can't. neck set with hide glue, you know, inlays, neck shape, fret materials, you know, any kind of custom woodworking. If we're gonna get into changing materials, bridges, bindings, we can do that all here now. You know, any kind of custom color finish, wiring options, pickup options. But these will all be based on existing models.
Okay.
Eastman offers. You know, so essentially a custom guitar with, you know, that all the details are as good as they possibly can be. You know, expertly assembled in the USA, I think is our coin phrase.
Sure. So it sounds like China does maybe 20% of the work and then 80% of the work is done in California.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to say, as when you're talking about time,
yeah.
I'm going to say that. That's true.
Okay.
But if you look at it, it comes in looking like a guitar.
Okay. Okay.
Which they do amazingly well.
Sure.
You know, this wood is all sourced here. You know, all these tops are bought, you know, from John at Old Standard.
Yep.
I know. Indian rosewood is better than, I mean, the trade routes are better through Asia than they are through here. The wood is unbelievable. The wood workmanship is unbelievable. So all we got to do is make it play and look great, and these will be stunning guitars.
Okay. And so... Yeah,
from there, you know, it just becomes what is in store for Eastman in the future.
Sure.
And then that's where my shop kind of steps forward to kind of push, you know, the new guitar, you know, the new electric, maybe the new acoustic, maybe the new vision for, you know, something else. But it was one thing that I always, having my own shop, struggled with a lot, because I always wanted to do something off the wall, but never had, the opportunity to, you know, financially, I had to figure out a way to sell this thing at the end of the day, or find a person to purchase it.
Yeah. You know, Eastman kind of, I remember when they first came out with the arch top, it was a pretty revolutionary, interesting thing, you know, this affordable, fine quality arch top. Are your hands also in their flat tops and kind of everything they're making guitar wise?
Yeah, it runs the whole line. So Winter NAMM will probably unveil, you know, at least a half a dozen instruments that are just simple revisions of, you know, arch tops, electrics, flat tops, thin lines, you know, possibly, you know, a solid body electric as well.
Nice. And what about mandolins? Do you work on those too?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly have to. One area that I haven't figured out how to do custom versions of them yet, but we already have a bunch of people asking for those. So yeah, it's on the list for sure.
Just not enough surface area to do your fun stuff.
Yeah, but yeah, we're about a month into it now, so
okay.
Really no time at all.
Yeah.
You know, there's still a few tools that I'm still looking to find here or move here from Rhode Island, since when I did leave, some pieces just got left there or, you know, handed off to a friend and said, here, take care of this, don't lose it.
Sure.
So I just need to find out the best way if there's, you know, something I can find here easily. That's fine, but if it comes down to shipping it across the country, so be it.
Yeah, yeah. And talk to me about, I'm assuming at some point you have to go to China and work with the workers over there. Is that true?
Yeah. I've been going on a rotation there, you know, once a year. It'll probably be twice a year.
And but, tell me, for folks who just can't even wrap their heads around, you know, I know it probably looks a lot more old world than most of the kind of quote unquote, you know, handmade guitar operations in America. But, you know, tell us a little bit as much as you can about, you know, how many people work there and what the setting looks like.
So the operation probably has about 600 employees.
Wow.
The vast majority of that are for the strings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've never been to China before, there's all of these small little buildings and alleyways there. I don't know why they build, like someone said, it's the hutong, which is like it's like the back alley.
Mm-hmm.
But even the houses and villages are set up like that. It's just this idea of living space and communities. And but it's really cool because you can walk past these, alleyways, and in each one of these rooms is there's somebody working on this one thing, whether it be an upright base, he's carving a top, or this one guy who's pressing sides, and they take a lot of pride in what they do, so, and sometimes they're a little skeptical about who's watching us, is he stealing my ideas, is this the next guy to take my job, mm-hmm. Whatever it is, but it's just amazing to see, these workers or these few workers, working on this one thing and doing it really well. The main building is 4 floors, and the guitar shop is up on the 3rd floor, and it's the whole floor, and that's where the archtops are made in Beijing.
Okay.
There's also a separate facility outside of Tianjin, which does all the flat tops, and they're a little more automated. So they'll have, routers that are set up to do the dovetailing now. But it's still very, very simple machine. It'll take the body and the neck, and it'll cut them at the same time, and it's the perfect angle. Just because they used to do this by hand, and that was terrible. But they'll still, hand fit and, cut out the shoulder and fit everything and glue it there. But it's a pretty, in the main carving room where they're doing all the carving for the archtops, I guess the one thing that always kind of is unbelievable is there's just the sound of the tools, There's this carving sound, and there's some hammers that are tapping in frets, and then there's some guy, banging on a neck, putting it in, and but just all this sound is just so impressive, because each one of these, that sound is like one guitar, and there's 50 of them at at the same time, but it's definitely a sight to behold if you're ever through Beijing. It's a wonderful visit to take.
I bet.
To this shop. It's the most, everybody there is just so hospitable. I mean, it's just hospitality everywhere, and the food is pretty unbelievable.
Yeah. and they've been doing this for what, almost a dozen years. What do you bring to the table? Where do they need the most help?
I would have to say communication.
Yeah, sure.
All of the workers there are so prideful of what they do, and they really enjoy what they're doing and where they're doing at, that you just have to find a way to, mention something. And it's kind of like a marriage, I would imagine.
Yeah.
You don't want to say, this is wrong. You got to figure out a way to do it, because this is not it. You have to show them this is how you're going to do it. This is the best way, and this is why, and then, it happens, we still have issues with frets sometimes, so it's coming down to the process that they found works for them.
Yeah.
But it's all the details, and they getting better every year. We're getting a lot better. So
nice. Well, I'm excited to see what's up with you guys over at the next few NAMMs, and I'd love to come see your shop sometime. Cool. Thank you so much, Otto. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you, Jason.
And keep us posted on your latest and greatest.
I sure will. We're on Instagram, Facebook, all that stuff.
Perfect. We love Instagram is one of the greatest gifts for people who just want to look at guitar porn all day long.
It's that's right, man.
Quite the time waster without any of the politics of Facebook. It's pretty great.
Yeah, minimal words, all porn.
Yeah, pretty much. All right. Well, thanks so much.